The Undisclosed Addendum featuring D. Watkins is brought to you by two great sponsors, Mack Weldon and Spike TV's presentation of Time, the Cleve Browder story. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Also, we just want to remind our listeners that the opinions and analysis of our guests belong to our guests. Enjoy the program.
Hey, it's D. Watkins, host of Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. Today's going to be a great show. We have so many things that we need to cover and that I can't wait to talk about. But before we actually get started, I want to extend an invitation to anybody around the city who has questions about or who doubts some of the research that we have presented or are going to present. Because, you know, the whole idea and the point of this is to bring about the truth. People, you know, citizens, we work hard, we pay taxes, we deserve to know what happened. As Americans, we're responsible for challenging our system when our system isn't performing the way we think it should perform. So, you know, if anyone wants to clear their name or has any type of resistance to some of the things that we present, you know, reach out to our team of producers. All of the information will be posted, and we want to hear what you have to say. You can give us a phone call. You can come into the studio and look us right in the eye. Whatever you want to do, just let us know, because I think we're open to have those conversations. With that being said, I'm joined today by Amelia. You know her. She's done amazing research. She was with me on the first episode, and, you know, I'm happy that she's back again, and she'll be co-hosting the show with me, I think. You know, we're going to work together, and this is going to be really good. And we're lucky to be joined today by Mr. Harold Perry, who was actually a neighbor of Freddie Gray, and he witnessed the arrest. How you doing today, Mr. Harold?
I'm fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Amelia?
Hi. How are you?
I'm great. Let's start with a recollection of the events taking place that you witnessed from your eyes, Mr. Harold.
Well, on that morning of April 12th, I was lying in my bed. It was approximately between 8:15 and 8:25. I was surfing the TV trying to find one of the religious channels, Jamal Bryant, Dante Hickman, or someone that my wife and I generally listen to on Sundays. And I heard this commotion outside. Why are you grabbing me? I haven't done anything. This is what Mr. Gray was saying to the bicycle police, and they were holding him. And then I heard him say, "What are you holding me for? I haven't done anything. All I'm doing is trying to get home." And the larger of the policemen, I presume, said to him, "Shut the F up. Come on over here," and snatched him towards the curb on the left-hand side of the projects.
Okay, so is that common language for police officers, or was that something different from your perspective?
No. That is sort of typical here in this area, but I don't think it's common for a police officer to speak to anyone like that. It's sort of disrespectful right from the jump. So they tussled him over to the side of the apartment on the other side, at the lower end where the front of the buildings begin, and it's a rail there, and there's also sort of a stoop, which is about 2 feet high. And they threw him down there, and I was trying to wake my wife to see if she could tell me exactly what was going on, because at the time, my eyes were leaving me. I am blind, and I could see at that point certain things, but they would be blurry. I couldn't make them out. And Freddie Gray was hollering, "Get off my back. You're hurting my neck. You're hurting my neck. I can't breathe. I have asthma."
Because Gray's not the biggest, he wasn't the biggest guy in the world, but the cop was heavy, right? He was a heavy gentleman.
Weighed at least 300 pounds, at least. Yeah. And I know Freddie Gray from what I've heard from other guys. I did not know him personally. I've been told that I've seen him on numerous occasions walking by, and he spoke to my wife and I on the front. But as far as recognizing him and things, no, I did not. But Kevin, one of the young men that knew him quite well, who also witnessed some of what was going on and had commentated about it, he told me that Freddie was very, very light. He wasn't 125 soaking wet in his estimation.
Yeah, he was very thin. He was, you know, I think he was only about 5'8", actually. And, you know, 130 pounds maybe.
And this cop is a big guy. Amelia, do you have any, was it reported his size or?
I think you could probably look on K-Search. I think he's somewhere over around the 200, you know, around that mark. So this is Garrett Miller. He's one of the bike cops who initially detained Freddie. Yeah, he's a larger gentleman, let's put it that way. Husky.
Okay, he's like a husky men's department.
Yeah,
those policemen had on yellow and blue and helmets and were riding bikes that first approached him and pulled him to the side of that building. And he was continuously hollering, "Somebody help me, please. You're hurting my neck. Get off of my neck. You're hurting my neck. I have asthma. I can't breathe." And it kind of quietened for about 3 or 4 minutes. And I was kind of lost. I didn't know what was going on. And then I saw them lifting him up. And they were literally carrying him. He was holding on to each of their shoulders. And they were bringing him up the street. They got him to...
Was he screaming at that point, or...?
No, they were just... He was just holding on, and they were bringing him up the street. And as they got him to the end of the building, two police cars pulled up in front of my door. Two in the first car, a white shirt, I would presume a sergeant or lieutenant or something, and another officer. And in the second car, one officer. The first car, the lieutenant or whomever, ran across the street, keys jingling, and he said, "Put him on the ground, put him on. He's not shackled right to be transported." And they laid him down on the ground, and he jumped on that boy's back. And Freddie started hollering, "Get off of my legs, you're hurting my back, you're hurting my back. God, somebody help me, please." And it seemed like he was looking up at me. I was in my window, and I felt, I don't know how, I mean, it was just soul penetrating, the sound of his voice. And you could tell that this boy was really in agony. And the police said to him, "Shut the F up," just like that.
Yeah.
And he kept commenting, "Get off of my legs, please, somebody, please help me." And it was people on the corner out here and things, and they were saying something, "Get off of him," or something they were hollering. And the officer didn't pay them any mind. He went about doing what he was doing. After they shackled them, I guess the way they wanted to, a wagon pulled in from off of Mount Street, pulled straight into the driveway, face forward, facing the cans, and the back doors of the whoever was driving got out and opened the back doors. And they lifted him up. His feet was literally dragging the tips of his feet. He was not walking as they stated. He walked to that van. This boy could not move his feet. His feet were like a paraplegic's feet, pointing down when somebody was trying to carry him. And that's the way he was put to that van.
Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, I think that the part of why Freddie was sort of dragging his feet and also why he was screaming at them to get off his legs is they had put him in a leg lace for a number of minutes, in addition to sort of what you witness in terms of getting on his back and stuff. And, you know, you're kept in a leg lace for long enough and you start to lose feeling in addition to it being painful.
Well, I didn't see him put him in any kind of brace or anything. That officer was just on his back.
Yeah.
And he was handcuffed behind his back. And he just seemed to be looking up at me, begging, "Please, somebody help me." And I felt so much empathy and just feeling helpless that I could not help this young man, because I've seen so much of this sort of treatment to our young African-American men in this area. by the police officers. Wanted, there's a lot of crime in Baltimore. There's a lot of crime in all cities across America. But it doesn't mean that the police have to commit a crime to combat a crime. And this seems to be the norm for what's going on today. They're doing just as wrong as the people that they're arresting for doing wrong.
Mack Weldon is better than anything you're wearing right now. In fact, it's the best thing I'm wearing right now, and here's why. So my mom gave me some guff about a picture of me in the local paper recently. The paper wanted me to talk about Undisclosed recent story arc, and they needed a picture of me. So I sent them a picture, and it's me in a black Mack Weldon t-shirt. My mom sees it, and she says to me, "Why are you always wearing the same black t-shirt all the time?" I had to tell her it's not the same t-shirt, it's that I have like four black t-shirts all by Mack Weldon. I love the product that much. Mack Weldon is my go-to brand for comfortable men's clothing, and it has been for a while now. I wear Mack Weldon underwear, socks, shirts. The gear breathes so well. So if you're looking for some new, stylish, efficient menswear for you or a man in your life, Mack Weldon should be your brand. To top it off, Mack Weldon has a great return policy. Mack Weldon wants you to be comfortable, so if you don't like your first pair, you can keep it, and they will still refund you. No questions asked. There's no good excuse not to try Mack Weldon now, so get some for yourself or that significant male other in your life, or the insignificant male other who you think is kind of neat but needs some fresh threads. And when you do buy those stylish threads, make sure you use the promo code UNDISCLOSED. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code UNDISCLOSED. You're going to get 20% off. MackWeldon.com, promo code UNDISCLOSED.
You know, I wanted to ask you, Harold, one of the sort of more interesting things that you just talked about and that you told me during our interview was about seeing the two police cars pull up in front of your house and seeing a white-shirted officer jump out of the front seat, who you rightfully sort of are right to assume was probably a lieutenant or a sergeant, since they don't typically wear the blue uniforms or the bike uniforms. I was curious, did you happen to notice, you know, was this a white officer? Did the person have hair?
The two white officers jumped out of the first car. It was a black officer who was alone in the second car. And when he went across the street, he seemed so hesitant, and he seemed like he was ashamed of what was going on and whatever. He kind of stood back and kind of assessed it rather than to assist. And something was said to him by the officer in the white shirt that was on Freddie Gray's back at the time. I didn't make that out, but that officer, the black officer, did not seem to be pleased with what he saw going on.
Right. It's just so interesting because ever since you told me about that, I've been trying to figure out who that white-shirted officer could be. And I haven't quite figured it out yet, but I'm looking forward to finding out because, you know, one of the things is that a lot of what you told me and a lot of what a lot of other witnesses told me doesn't happen to appear on the CCTV footage from that particular stop.
A lot of things that I saw was not shown. And for one thing, I don't understand all these cameras that they have on these buildings. Whenever they arrest these people here for drugs and other crimes, that footage is readily available. Why wasn't it available for these officers at this time? And it was right there in front of the camera. I mean, the camera was not even 10 feet from where they were wrestling this man down on the ground when Freddie Gray was screaming, "Get off my legs, you're hurting my back. Please, somebody help me, God." I mean, the camera is right there. Mm-hmm. And they showed no footage from this, not none. They didn't offer any footage.
I was just going to say, you know, they did on the about a week and a half after Freddie was injured, and actually about 4 days after he passed away, sadly, the police department uploaded some footage from the various sort of stops around the city, including from the arrest. But, you know, it's all very innocent looking. And one of the things that we'll be getting into on the podcast is really taking a really, really close look at that footage and trying to figure out whether or not it matches the story that we've been told by the police and by the prosecutor's office. And, you know, where, because as far as I'm concerned, the fact that it's that what you've described isn't on the footage does not at all, in my opinion, mean that what you saw did not happen. Footage can be edited. And while I'm not saying that that is absolutely the case here, because I don't want to give away any spoilers, but let's just say that I am looking very, very closely at that footage, and I certainly see some issues with it.
From what was told by the police, they distorted a lot of the truth, and they misled people in all sort of directions. In my estimation, that boy was hurt by those two bicycle police right there at the end of the building. This man could not walk. Mm-hmm. He had to be carried from the end of those railings in that ramp that goes down to where they had him over there. And they said it's no way possible that anything could have happened over there. It's nothing. There is a ledge that is walked down a ramp with rails on it that has about 2 feet of concrete up in the air, or a little more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That his head or his body could have been wedged up on while this big man was pouncing all up on him. This is where that young man was hurt. He could not walk from that moment that they jumped on him till the time that they put him in that wagon. I sit in my window watching all of this.
Yeah.
That boy was carried.
So I want to ask you this about what you saw and what you heard and the response from the people who actually investigated the case. Did you get a chance to tell your story during any of the trials? Were people who were trying to prosecute these officers, did they interview you?
I was not subpoenaed by any of the lawyers for the defense or the prosecution. I told my story to homicide police who came here to question me, a lady and a man. I have their card in my wallet as I speak. I'm unable to look at it and tell you their names or the name of the gentleman who left this card and had me call him, and they returned my call and came here to talk to me in my living room. And I told them everything that I'm telling you right now.
So what do you think the reason for that is?
Well, I think the whole thing is that the FOP has too much clout. And what needs to be done is there needs to be a civil committee to regulate the FOP, because they don't seem to be able to regulate themselves. Police regulating police is going to always be a problem.
Right.
So you need something there that will deter their thinking to keep them from doing things like this. And that would be a civil committee, a body of citizens here that will control whatever efforts and are able to judge whether or not they should be prosecuted for their crimes rather than the police.
Next Wednesday at 10 p.m. on Spike, from executive producers Sean J.Z. Carter and Harvey Weinstein, the groundbreaking six-part documentary event series continues. Time, the Khalif Browder story. Browder was a 16-year-old African-American high school student from the Bronx walking home from a party when he was arrested for allegedly stealing a backpack. He then spent an unthinkable 3 years in Rikers Island without ever being convicted of a crime. This week's episode takes a deep and dark dive into Browder's time in solitary confinement and how he withstood the prolonged psychological and physical abuse from being locked away inside a box. It also examines the broken criminal justice system that left Browder to rot in solitary for years while he waited for his day in court. The series uses first-person accounts, unprecedented archival footage, and interviews with politicians, friends, and family, all to take a comprehensive look at Khalif's story. So that's Time, the Khalif Browder story, and it continues next Wednesday at 10 p.m. on Spike.
When I caught my first gun charge, boys looking funny, crazy, we was gone hard. Me and B crept down on the buggin', but the gun jammed, so I couldn't complete the job.
One of the major things that this case has done is, you know, there was already a big problem with trust between community members and police officers, but this case was kind of, it put the nail in the coffin, because it showed us that even if, you know, you have outrage, not just from the citizens of Baltimore, but from the nation, a story that gets national attention and just had a tremendous negative impact on people everywhere. You know, we see all of this energy, and then we see some of the officers who were involved in this case, and, you know, we see they get charged, but zero convictions. Just the trust has just been dismantled. And, you know, if you can speak to this too, Amelia, what do you think people are looking for, or, you know, how can you get some of that trust back? Or even, well, I guess I can't say back because it was never there. Like, where do we start if we wanted to move towards that direction?
I mean, I think that's been one of the most interesting things about investigating this case is, you know, I remember when Marilyn Mosby stood on the steps and announced the charges against the officers. And I remember feeling, oh, my God, she's charging six. This is pretty rare when that many officers get charged. I mean, occasionally officers do get charged, but in this case, it was already getting so much attention. And I remember feeling, oh my God, this is incredible. She's a hero. This is it. And then when I took a little closer look at the actual narrative, the story she sort of told to go along with the charges, I found myself thinking, wait, really? That's the story? Because it didn't, you know, it took so much focus off of the initial first couple of stops, what people like Harold had been talking to the media about for a couple of weeks, and put a lot of focus on the van driver and, you know, the possibility that Freddie was injured during this ride. And what's been interesting has been to sort of investigate the case and to see how that story came together, because I think it's ultimately what led to, you know, that story did not go over very well in court. They didn't do the best job proving it. And I wonder, what we've been wondering is that because this wasn't true, the story that they presented? Is the real truth something different?
They were trying to make that van driver an scapegoat. They were trying to use her as an scapegoat because she knew that she wasn't supposed to transport that boy from that spot. He was supposed to receive some medical help right there before he was put into that wagon. And they persuaded her to take that boy. And then somewhere down the line, around the corner or whatever, she had second thoughts and tried to change it. And she began to argue with them. And they wanted her to take him to the 5th District. She wouldn't take him there. They were scared to take him there. And they wanted her to take him to the bookings, knowing that they would not accept him there. And she was just going to be an scapegoat.
Well, Caesar was the driver, right?
Yeah, Caesar Goodson. So the van driver was actually the guy, and then...
Yeah, the van driver was the guy.
Yeah, so that's Goodson.
It was a big stink from the police, and they stink to heaven, and they don't deserve to wear the uniforms that they wear. They state that they are here to serve and protect. And who did they serve and protect on that disgraceful morning that this young man's life was taken from him? For running up and down the street? What law states that you cannot run? People run and jog here every day in every city across America. They stopped him. Then they claimed he had a knife that was legally 4 inches long, they claim, after. But they never approached him about a knife from what was brought out. I mean, they tried all kinds of ways to bring this boy into some sort of negativity to give them a reason for stopping him.
Oh, yeah, they put him on trial in the media before we even got to the bottom of the story or what happened. They already tried to create a narrative of him being a person that would deserve their treatment when that's not the case.
Correct. I mean, and then after it was all said and done, they saw that they couldn't make this fly. So they start switching up, shifting the blame from one to the other. And Marilyn Mosby, not knowing where she was and having to depend on what the police were saying, because none of our fine citizens had the backbone to stand up and tell what they saw for fear of retaliation from the Metropolitan Police Department. And believe me, it exists.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because you're one of the people, obviously, who's been wonderful enough to tell me what you saw and then to come on our program today. But it has been a struggle as I've tried to find people to talk about this case because there's a feeling of either people feel like, is this such a good idea for me to be talking about this? Worrying, like you said, about some form of retaliation that they'll become, you know, maybe targets for police in the area, sort of screwing with them. Or I think I've also talked to a number of people who were speaking out early on after Freddie was injured, who now are sort of like, what's the point? Who feel let down by the fact that, you know, speaking out back in April 2015 didn't end up having the impact that they hoped. And that's been really heartbreaking because I don't have anything to say to that. I don't blame people for being frustrated and feeling a little hopeless about the situation. Is there a reason why you feel that you've continued to speak out about this?
I spoke out because this young man reached me through his cries and his prayers and pleading for someone to help him. That is something that I wake up in the middle of the night hearing. This boy screams, and believe me, I've heard nothing like it in my life. I've been in the Army, I've traveled a lot, I've lived in ghettos across America, and this is the first time I've heard what I've heard and felt the empathy and things for this young man. To those people who have knowledge of what's going on, and who state that they don't like the quality of the life that they are living in Baltimore, they need to have backbone and stand up for the rights that they want to have. Because everything worth having is worth fighting for, anything you want. And this is what they need to do. And regardless, it doesn't say who your enemy or your foe is going to be. It's you fight for your rights, regardless of whom they are. And that's the way I was brought up, and that's the way I believe. As a young man, I grew up in Washington, and they had a beat police who walked the beats, and this was his area. And he had formed a rapport with the people of the community. He went in the stores, he drank coffee, he talked to the people, the patrons, he helped the kids across the street. It was things that they did to show that they had an interest in the people and for the people, not running, chasing them down the street, drawing their guns every time somebody pulls up in a car. It's a whole different time.
Yeah.
True that there are things going on in Baltimore and other cities that, hey, nobody agrees with. Nobody wants to see women raped trying to go to work or jogging through the park or whatever. Nobody wants to be stuck up in a store or going to the store to order something to eat and the store is being robbed and you get killed like some people have accidentally been done here in Baltimore. No, nobody agrees with that type of life. But what needs to be done is it's got to be a better rapport between the people in the police department. People have to know that you're here to serve, to protect us, and this is not what's known now. It's basically like Gestapoism. When they come to kick doors down, to drag somebody out, or chase somebody through your area. And how can you tell somebody you for them, and this is all you bring to their community? But when you go home, you can rest your head. Nobody's running through your area. Nobody's kicking your doors down.
Right. Yeah. Well, Dee, you grew up in Baltimore and, you know, you live there now. Has it ever in the sort of your lifetime, do you remember there being a situation where the Baltimore police were more part of the community, where they were kind of frequenting coffee shops or making conversation with people on their stoops? Has it ever been like that in your recollection?
So I'm from a neighborhood in East Baltimore called Down the Hill. So one, we never had a coffee shop. There's no coffee shops around there.
A corner store.
But But I will say this. When I was a little kid, talking like second, third grade, we used to have like Officer Friendly who would come to the school and he would talk to the kids about, you know, staying out of drug free zones, which was always weird to us kids because we all lived in drug free zones. When they hang up a drug free zone in your neighborhood, it just means that you live in a neighborhood with a bunch of drugs. So I guess they try to hang the sign up to try to deter people, but it's already too late because we're growing up in open air drug markets. So as kids, they will come to the school. By the time, you know, you get in middle school, it's already baked into the narrative that, yo, cops, they not here to look out for you. They're here to look out for themselves. They take the job to get a salary and benefits, and you're not going to have a good experience with them. And as you grow up, that narrative only gets stronger. Now, as an adult, you know, and I say this as, you know, I'm in my 30s now, and I can sit here and honestly say that if you shot me, if you, you know, hit me over the head with a gun, if anything happened to me, I wouldn't. And I'm a journalist. I'm a college professor. I'm a writer who travels the world. If you bring any harm towards me, I would never call the police. The only time I would ever call a police officer ever, and I, you know, I pay taxes and I got retirement accounts and, you know, like I've done some things. The only time I would ever call a police officer is if I needed a report to show to my insurance company.
Wow.
That's the only time. I would never, like I said, we can go out here right now and, you know, anything can happen to me. I don't think it's a point. You know, I've never had an experience where they would come and say anything positive. I never looked at them as allies or people who wanted to save the day. That relationship hasn't existed. And I'm not saying that that's everybody's experience, but I still live in East Baltimore. So when I walk up and down these streets and when I talk to people and when I ask them about their experiences, you know, the same thing echoes over and over again. You know, these people are allies to the community from my perspective. Now, somebody else might have a different experience, but I can only give you my perspective. So again, this is why I said what I said at the beginning of the show, because if I'm wrong, or if you think we're wrong, then the door's open for someone to come in and counter any of these arguments. But this is the culture that we live in. This is what exists.
Yeah, I mean, my whole thing is that, you know, that's not my personal experience. I didn't grow up in, you know, super wealthy areas by any means, but the police, I never really had any negative or positive encounters with the police. They weren't on every corner as they are in certain areas of Baltimore. But I also recognize that, like, my experience is just one experience and your experience is another experience, and they're valid. And the very fact that someone like you, Dee, that entire communities largely will feel this way, can feel like harm could be caused to them, and they still will not call the people whom they pay taxes to protect them, to help them, and that there are so many people who do not feel like they can do that is a travesty. And that's
taxpaying citizens feeling like they can't call the people who collect their tax dollars.
Yeah. And that doesn't mean that every single police officer is terrible. Of course not. But to talk about policing as if it's about individual police officers is missing the point. It's about policing as an institution and how it is utilized in different communities and how it's not working in a lot of places. And when it's not working in whole communities, that's not okay.
Okay, by the same token, everyone that lives in the ghetto is not a bad person.
Absolutely.
And I see young men walking by my door, holding conversations with one another about what they've tried to do to get a job or to get back into school and this and that. I can't afford to go to school because I have a kid, and at that time, I can be earning money to help feed my kid rather than be in school. All of these problems exist here, and until some of those are faced, you're going to have the problems with drugs and other crimes here, because these kids, they don't have any way to acquire anything. They can't get jobs because a lot of them have criminal records. And the reasons why are because this is like a rabbit in a hunting field. And the hunter, all he has to do, he knows the rabbit's going to be there. All he has to do is grab the rabbit he wants.
Yeah.
And they take him and they get a criminal record. And from that point on, it's much more difficult. I hear young men who just come home from federal institutions or state institutions or whatever, and they cry about, man, I thought when I got home, I could just get something to get me going. And I've talked to a few of them. And how can you give someone encouragement who is in dire need of just the essentials, food, water, shelter? You know, I mean, it's a terrible situation. Nothing's going to be done before these things are met. You have to deal with the big necessities of what this community needs. We need small businesses for opportunities for employment. We need a lot of things in our community. There is not a grocery store in this community within 15 blocks in any direction that you go in. If you try to get a hack to go to them, they're going to charge you $10 or more, depending upon where you're going.
For people who don't know, a hack is like an Uber for black people. It's like hacks was out before Uber. You just, you know, you put your thumb, you go to the curb and you put your thumb up. You're like, hey, you know, and then Unc pull up in the car and, you know, you get in there. And he going to take you around where you need to get at. Had to translate a little bit, Mr. Harold. Everybody, a lot of listeners, they don't know what a hack is.
Okay. But then you got to pay $10 to go. And after you get your food, you got to pay 10 or more to bring your food back. I mean, come on. Then you have your kids, you have the clothes, medicines for them. I mean, all kinds of things, man. I mean, and it's not easy. You got the city giving us rain tax. Come on. God gave us rain, but they charge us. Rain tax.
You know, you spoke to a good point when you talk about the lack of opportunities, because a lot of people, like, they don't even understand the history of where some of these things come from. I mean, housing projects was the big thing that black people got from the GI Bill. You being discriminated after you coming home from fighting in a war, and you think that, you know, you'll get an opportunity to benefit from that GI Bill, but we going to the projects. Other people, white people who fought in that same war, got an opportunity to build these white suburbs that exist today. So it's like you can actually be a black person, fight for this country, and then come home. Not only is you not going to be able to get a sandwich and a counter at the deli if it's not a full-colored deli, but you're also not going to have access to that money to go to school and to be able to get those home loans to buy those houses in the suburbs where that middle class actually came from.
Well, that's a good point, because when I came home from the service in 1969, I applied to Strayer Business College, which was located on 13th Street Northwest in Washington, D.C. at the time. They were just starting. And I went there on my GI Bill. Strayer got paid, but I never received a dime from my GI Bill for going to school, and I had to drop out, you know. And I had kids, and I had to find employment.
Yeah, so the roots of these issues go deep. So it's like, you know, a lot of times when people come with simple solutions to the problem. So when I say, the way I was talking about how I'd see police officers in my history, as far as what I understand, this isn't just my story. If you talk to my father, he's going to say the same thing. And, you know, I don't know who my grandparents was or nothing like that, but a bunch of people who are like, you know, the age that somebody who would be like my grandparents, you know, that age, they're going to say the same thing. So it's like a tradition of not trusting police officers that just exist within our community. That's why we got to go back and we got to say, well, what kind of move do they have to make to start that connection? Because, you know, we already made the first move. You got our tax money. You and our neighborhood. We made the first move. We made the first move. We're providing a salary for you to offer a service. And I think a lot of cops don't really understand that they work for all citizens, even the citizens who are in between jobs. Like, you know, you're a public servant. You know, you're a servant. So you should be there to serve the people, not break their backs and all that.
The basic thing they don't understand is that we all live off of osmosis. We all breathe the same air. We all have to eat, sleep, and defecate. And so what they should understand, regardless of the pigmentations of your skin, you are brothers and sisters, because you are atmospheric creatures. You breathe the same air. You live off of the same air. You drink the same waters. You eat the same foods. And that's where it all begins. That would help end the line of prejudice that goes along. If you notice, kids don't have prejudices. Kids play together. Regardless of the way your eyes are, the color of your skin, how nappy your head is, or whatever, kids don't see that. So why should adults, people who are supposed to have been educated, supposedly intelligent, able to think for themselves and to distinguish right from wrong, it is still a lot of prejudices going on and about the most simple, ignorantest things in the world. And that is where it all begins, and this is where it has to stop. You have to teach your kids. If you say things about people in a racial manner, your kids pick it up from you, and they carry it on.
Born to love, taught to hate.
That's right. So this is where it's got to stop. You got to think before you speak in front of your kids. You got to think before you act and do things in front of your kids. They mimic everything you do. And this is what my wife and I discuss in here at all times with my granddaughter. We try to break down and decipher whatever her thoughts are and give her the correct approach to that and let her know that, hey, it's all going to fall on you because one day you're going to be out there by yourself and you're going to have to make that decision.
I'm adapting to a violent condition. I'ma probably end up in the jailhouse with them. They gon' have to lock me in a maximum prison.
A lot of what Baltimore is today, I'm ashamed to say, it's drug infested. The drug use here is something, but it's a sickness. And a lot of people, I've talked to guys and they've cried to me, I really want to stop, man. I can't find any help. All of this. My wife used to work in that field with a lot of drug users and things. And sometimes she would give them information, people to go to. And a couple have come by and said thank you to her. And it's not enough money's going around in the right way to help people. All of these people out here on pills, you name it, they're taking it, not knowing what's in it, who did it, and whatever. Now I'm told they're using a horse tranquilizer. I mean, a horse tranquilizer.
Yeah.
If the horse can't stand it, how the hell do you think you're going to stand it? I mean, come on. It's ignorant. I mean, and they just seem like they don't have any care about themselves, that you would allow yourself to put this into your system. It's shameful.
But it is a sickness, you know? It is a sickness. And I think that people look at drug addicts or people who do drugs as if they are disposable, and that's not cool. I mean, it is a sickness, and we don't offer people who are having those troubles the resources they need. I mean, help. Pretty soon, a lot of people aren't going to have health insurance, if they even have it now.
So what you're saying, by it being the first rule of life, self-preservation, means to put anything in your system that you feel you can exist off of. No, that's not right. Not in my mind.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of other things that I could put in my system that, other than a drug, you know. People don't eat vegetables. When I grew up, my grandmother had turnips.
Yeah.
I mean, beets, rhubarb. I mean, all kinds of things. And a lot of times, they were mixed in a pot together. And you felt the strength of it after you ate. It might not have looked good or appetizing to you. It might not have smelled good. But it was nourishing once you got it into your system.
Not just new stuff. I saw a 16-pound apple the other day.
What?
It wasn't 16 pounds, but I know it was too big to be an apple. I was like, yo, a pumpkin's red now. And they're like, no, that's an apple. I was like, oh, okay. And what they, what kind of hormones or, you know, I guess then it explains why all these kids are like 6'7", you know, tall because, you know, they eating the hormone apples yeah. and the chickens with the injections and all that, you know.
Yeah.
Well, see, these people have a lot better life than what we had when we were kids. I mean, I remember my grandfather scraping chicken feet before and washing them before they were being cooked. All of that type of stuff, chicken necks. We didn't have breasts, legs, wings. We had the necks, the feet, the gizzard, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, so they've got so much more.
But so long as you have access to it.
Yeah. I mean, in school, we didn't have books. You had to share a book with three or four people. Now everybody has a book. Everybody's on a computer.
Yeah. At good schools, you know, you still have that going on in some of these schools here in Baltimore. You have the kids sharing books and the teachers have to make copies and things that just shouldn't be going on. It's just like a, you know.
And then on the flip side, you have schools that have every kid has an iPad. I mean, it's like there's a total imbalance in the way certain kids have everything, more than they need, and then other kids have nothing.
Luxury of tax base. If you're at a school where, you know, your neighborhood has a good tax base, you're going to have little iPads and, you know, your iPads are going to have little iPads that come with them. But if you're in a school without resources, like a lot of schools in Baltimore, like the neighborhood that we're focused on, the Gil Mahomes area, then the schools are going to be underfunded and they're not going to have the things that young people need to compete. And then you wonder why some of our young people graduate and they're not able to participate at the highest level in the workforce. And it's because they went to school at a place that didn't have the things needed for them to be successful. Basic things like full access to technology. And, you know, let me ask you this. How are you going to be good in English when your English class is in a section of the building where the heat doesn't work? So every time you go to school and you know, you're supposed to be focusing on English, you're freezing because it just doesn't work. Like, how can you be successful? How do you game plan for cold? You can game plan for not having, you know, how do you game plan for that?
But at the same time, during the summer, your English class doesn't have a working air conditioner and everybody is barely able to breathe because it's so humid. You know, it's like, that's an ongoing problem in Baltimore. That was a whole big thing last summer. I remember reading in the newspaper that, you know, schools were closed on certain weekdays because it was just too hot and the air conditioners weren't working.
It's funny that it always works in the principal's office. It's like, mm-hmm. In the wintertime, the principal's office is nice and toasty. In the summertime, the principal's office is so cold, you know, you need to wear a sweater on a 90 degree day just to get through it. So let's bring some of these issues back in and get any of the remarks that we didn't get on that stop that you witnessed, Mr. Harrell, and then Amelia, if you can chime in and give some analysis to that based on some of the research you've done.
Well, I wanted to ask you, Harrell, you know, you live on, we should tell everybody, you live on the corner or towards the corner of Presbury and North Mount, and the house that you own, you actually had a mural painted of Freddie right there. Will you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, after I found out Freddie had passed and the guys were walking around moping and they were talking, we want to do something, man. We got to do something. And a young man named Brandon Ross came to my wife and I with the artist to whom did the work and approached us about the mural. And I was hesitant about it because I didn't want any political statements or any pornography or any negativity put on my wall. And they assured me that it would be above board and I would like it. So I said, well, I'm not going to give you an answer tonight. I'm going to talk to my wife, and y'all come back in a day or so, and I'll let you know. And they agreed. And my wife and I talked, and she said, well, I wanted to talk to you about putting something up there, but I was thinking of something more musical. She wanted to put something like jazz musicians or something on the wall at the time. And I talked to her, and I said, well, I still hear that boy screaming, baby. And, you know, and he says, help me, help me. And I couldn't help him at that time. But maybe if we allow that mural to be on the wall, it would be a form of helping him and getting a message out to the people that what happened to him should never happen to anyone else. And so we stood on the side, and Brandon kind of roughly described what they had planned to do on the wall, and I didn't agree with some of it at the time. And I told him, well, as you go, I'm going to be there watching, and I'll tell you what I'll agree with what's going on the wall. And the artist and I, we had a very good rapport, and he kind of picked up on what I wanted. And that's why the mural states the March in Selma, the Freddie Gray incident, and then what's the end of it is the protest of the marches in Baltimore, is the last one of his friends and what they kind of shown. And I'm satisfied with, very much satisfied with the way the artist did his job. And there's still a few things that I would like to continue to do. I would like to have lights placed at the top of the building so that they would light up at night, motion lights. I would like to do some things down to have a wall, a fence put around it so that it would keep the vandalism down. People have come and broken the flowers and stuff down. It's a lot of little things that I would like to do. We've filed for a go account at one point, and we allowed it to be up on for 2 months. No one ever donated anything to us, and come to find out that other people have had go accounts in Freddie Gray's name on the house.
Oh, what?
Wow. Yeah, and
wow.
They were receiving contributions. What's done to that mural in that garden, my wife and I pay for out of our pockets. We've had one person to give us something, and that was Home Depot donated some flowers and other materials so that we could do the garden. Kids from a local university who didn't want us to put them out there to publicize whom they are, they didn't want any credit for it. They came and they raked the grass, pulled up the weeds, and designed the way the garden is today. And they did it. It was excellent condition. And as time has gone on and people have allowed their dogs to roam on the memorial and everything, it's a it's a problem, but we deal with it. And it's a project that we undertook, and we're prepared to continue doing what we're doing. I mean, we have no regrets about having the mural put up for Freddie Gray, and we don't have any regrets about the part that we have to play in maintaining it. We knew that it would come down to us being by ourselves at a point.
A lot of people are going to hear this, and I think I want to ask you, Mr. Harold, if there's something that you would like to say to the police department in a way that could help them get a better understanding of how they should be doing their job to help people.
I think people all over the nation have said a lot of things to the police department, and the FOP is just working on dumb ears and blind eyes. They're blinder than I am. Everyone is capable of making a mistake. Even their kids have made mistakes. And if you can't find a little sympathy or whatever for what these people are going through, the living conditions to which they're living under, the things that they're being oppressed by. I mean, come on, where's your humanity? What do you go to church for?
Yeah, there's a real lack of empathy.
Yeah, your kids get in trouble and you want everybody to feel sorry for your kids because you're a police officer? No, it doesn't work like that. You're human like we're human. And that's all we want to be treated like, human beings, to understand that we're able to make mistakes. Our kids are able to make mistakes. But why should we be punished for the rest of our lives? I mean, if we don't take a life, and I don't agree with anybody that takes a life for any reason, because all things should be able to be worked out. And if you have any sense at all, and you sit down and you look at things, even when it comes to something that is going to disrupt your life, hey, all things pass. Read the Bible. All things pass. And there will be sunshine on another day. So, I mean, it's no reason. Give yourself a chance. And this is what a lot of young people here today are not doing, giving themselves a chance at life. They're looking at what another person is doing, what they have, and they're going to achieve that by any means necessary, and it's wrong. And for the police department, you asked me to speak to them, you know, just think of it, it's your child. When you go behind the doors and talk to the lawyers and the judges that you know and ask them, this is my child, he's not a bad person. Why can't you do that for someone else's child?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You want to add to that, Amelia?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I think the mural that you have on the side of your wall is beautiful. And I think it's amazing that you and your wife have funded this on your own. And our listeners tend to be generous people who are moved by stories like yours. And so I would love to see whether any of our listeners have any ideas about how to sort of support, you know, the upkeep perhaps of the garden and the mural that are next to Harold's home. Yeah, and I just wanted to thank you so much for continuing to speak with us and for being so generous with your time. You are an incredible human being, Mr. Perry.
Thank you so much. I would like to add to that and just say thank you as well. You know, I think you added it definitely a layer of a story that our listeners really, really, really needed to hear.
Well, it was very nice talking to you. You both have a very nice day.
And
thanks. Have a great day.
Your audience for listening.
Take care.
So I want to thank the visiting panelists for this week. You guys are great, as always. And a reminder for fans to please, please, please make sure you participate on social media. You can discuss the episode with the hashtag undisclosed or hashtag Freddie Gray. Tag questions for the future addendums with the hashtag UD addendum. Follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram using the handle @undisclosedPOD. You can follow me on social media at DWatkinsWorld and follow Amelia on Twitter at @ExoAmelia. Thank you and have a blessed day.
The Undisclosed Addendum featuring DWatkins was recorded at the Moose House Recording Studio in Baltimore. Ernesto and Ryan at Moose House take great care of us at their studio right outside of Druid Hill Park. Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media produced the addendum, along with super producer Methil Telhan. We want to thank our sponsors for this week's episode. They include Mack Weldon and Spike TV's airing of Time, the Khalif Browder story. Patrick Cortez composed the Undisclosed Addendum's theme music, and the embed track is Timeless by FMG Dez, a Baltimore artist who was kind enough to lend his sound to our show. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Monday for Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 3. Until then.